Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the voice of manufacturing globally. My name is Tim Grady. I'm here with my co-host, Lou Wise, and we're going to be talking to a gentleman from MAPI, the Manufacturing Alliance for Productivity and Innovation, today. We're going to be talking about the U.S. industrial outlook, but before we get to that, I'd like to talk to Lou and see how things are going in the news today. How are you doing, Lou?
Doing well. To switch to our postscript first for last week's show, we had a gentleman by the name of Jim Lawton, who was the Chief Product and Marketing Officer of Rethink Robotics, which is all about advanced robotics technology and the computer, the robot computer that they invented and is marketing, which is absolutely incredible. And we talked all about it. And it is a mobile, multi-purpose robot that works in the shop alongside your other employees. And they have all kinds of sensors, and it does all kinds of incredible things. One is called Sawyer, and the other is called Baxter. And surprisingly enough, it's cheaper to buy one of these robots than it is to buy an upgraded Cadillac. And it could make a huge difference in your manufacturing and productivity for your company. You also don't have a lot of people calling, robots calling in sick and going on vacation. And they work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The interesting point was that I think the payback is about,
I think it was 15, a year to 18 months at the outside.
Yeah, about that. And it's just incredible. And interchangeable arms and interchangeable tools that can be used to accomplish different tasks. So tune into last week's show about Rethink Robotics. And by the way, the address for them is rethinkrobotics.com.
I think their health plan, Lou, was a can of hydraulic fluid.
It must do wonders for the digestive system. In the news, hot stuff. Lockheed buys Sikorsky for $9 billion. It seemed like a marriage made in heaven. Lockheed wanted to get into the helicopter business, and United Technology wanted to get out of it. So it's a marriage that will do wonders for both companies. And take a look on it on the internet, and you'll see some very positive things that's going to come out of that for the aerospace industry. Item two is the Iranian nuclear deal, which I'm not going to really talk a whole lot about it because that's kind of more in the politics area, and I don't want to talk politics because I might voice an opinion that might prove to be inadvisable to put on the air. But that being said, once the Iranian deal is fully put into place, oil prices are probably going to go down. Actually, this morning, the price of crude was $50.78, down from $63 in May. And the word is that we may see $35 before the end of the year. I don't think that's going to do a whole lot of good for our economy. And perhaps Mr. Mextroff could give us some insight into that today in our show. So, Tim, back to you.
Thanks, Lou. We are talking with Dan Mextroff today. Dan is from the what's known as MAPI, the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. A very interesting organization, puts out a lot of reports for industry, and we're going to look at the U.S. industrial outlook probably for the next 90 days or so. And Dan is Vice President and Chief Economist for MAPI Foundation and also for MAPI. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We've had Dan on before, and Dan, we always love having a forecaster on the show to find out what's going to happen, what we think is going to happen. Everyone's kind of waiting for the economy to pick up. How does your report see it? How does it look?
Well, yes, I think it's going to pick up from the first half. As you know, the manufacturing sector was virtually flat in the first half versus the second half of 2014. The production dropped in the first quarter, primarily because of the weather, severe weather, but also the West Coast port strike and a number of other shocks that hit the economy, like oil prices and the appreciation of the dollar. So we think the sector has absorbed that, and so the second half will be stronger. But because the first half was essentially flat on a quarter-to-quarter or on a semi-annual basis, the growth rate for the year as a whole is going to be lower than it was last year. So last year, manufacturing production grew at a 3.5% year-over-year rate, and this year we're only looking for 2.5%. And then next year we do expect a pickup. You know, in 2014 we're looking for 4% growth, and then 2017 decelerating a little bit to 3.1% growth.
I think your 2.5% is right on, Dan. We've heard everything for the second half of the year, pressing upwards into the fours that are somehow going to magically lift the economy into the threes. We don't believe it, but I think your 2.5 is right on. Lou, would you agree?
Absolutely, and that may even be a push. You know, if we get some surprises, like some Iranian surprises or ISIS surprises, there's no telling what can happen. Dan, as you know, things affect our economy that we don't expect.
Yeah, and we certainly aren't going to get the acceleration that we got last year. But like in the second quarter, we had a severe winter in 2014 too. So this wasn't. I mean, this is the second year in a row where we've had very severe winter. I mean, the statistics have seasonal adjustments, so they can adjust for normal winters. But when you have extremely severe winters like we've had the last 2 years, it just can't. It overwhelms the seasonal adjustment. So the outlook last year, coming off the severe winter, we really exploded out. We had made up everything in the second quarter. Plus, we had a very strong rate of growth, annual rate of growth in the second quarter, third quarter, and then it decelerated a little bit in the fourth quarter. But it kind of jumped out of the box after a very weak first quarter. This year, that's not the case. This year, manufacturing production actually fell in the first quarter when it didn't. It only slowed substantially in the last year, and then we've had a relatively modest, only 1.5% annual rate pace of growth in the second quarter, and then we're looking for maybe 2.5 to 3% annual rates of growth in the third and fourth quarter. So because it's so weak in the first half of the year, you really can't make that up in the second half, because we don't see anything that's going to cause this big surge like we had last year coming out of the severe winter.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You'd have to be plugging the fives, Lou.
Do you see anything coming on the horizon in regards to increase in defense spending in view of a lot of... No. That was quick.
No, I don't. No, I think defense spending it's going to be winding down. There's no more stomach to really grow defense, to accelerate defense spending at this point. There's so many other pressing needs like infrastructure, and that I do not believe that defense spending is going to accelerate. It's not going to decline a lot, but it's going from this point, but it's going to slowly decline in after inflation adjusted terms.
In view of the fact that the Iranian deal has been signed, which I'm not sure how many people buy into it or believe it. And then the ISIS issue, and there's things happening in China. China building these artificial islands out into the middle of the Pacific. I think 200 altogether, and I think one has been just recently completed with armaments and all. I would think that the Defense Department would be kind of looking and saying, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Maybe we ought to be careful about decreasing further. I mean, there are those who believe that we're already way below where we should be. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dan?
Well, I'm not a defense expert, but my what I can see is that it may be that that other countries, particularly Japan and Vietnam and Korea and the countries in the region, have got more to worry about than we do. Obviously, what China is doing is it's a mineral grab, basically, is what it is. It's because of the exclusion zone around territory. So if they have an island, they can have a 200 mile exclusion zone around it. They can claim the minerals out from their coast, from those coasts. So it's really it's a mineral grab. China is looking down the road. They're heavy importers of raw materials, of minerals, to feed their their economy, and they're looking to secure the minerals. So I think it's provocative. It's inciting problems in the Southeast Asia, and they're making a lot of enemies. But I really think the Asians, Korea, Japan, and other countries in that region, they're the ones that need to respond more than we do. I mean, obviously we're going to be involved in that, but it's really really, it should be led by the countries that are directly involved with the disputes with China, and the U.S. is probably, I think, going to be more of a mediator than trying to mediate the dispute rather than being proactive. But China is going to exert itself over the future. It's a fast-growing economy. It's one of the largest population centers or countries and most heavily populated country in the world, they are growing their defense spending rapidly, but from extremely low base. So they're not anywhere near as sophisticated as the U.S. and NATO. So I don't think that's going to be a reason to, accelerate. We're still going to grow. I mean, military spending is shifting away from troops to equipment and technology, and so I think that's the way it's going to go. We're going to spend more money on technology and less on boots on the ground.
I just completed a book that I read. Actually on my vacation several weeks ago. It was called The 100-Year Marathon, The China Strategy. And it's the secret strategy that was created in 1949 and completion in 2049, and which are coming to that close. And it's a very interesting and in many ways a frightening book as to what's been going on in China that we never knew about and still don't know a lot about. And it all pieces together the things that they've been doing. It's all in the book, and it's all been part of their strategy of expansion. And, I read the book, and I said, we ought to vote for people who are for the defense spending, making sure we're up to speed. But interesting book written by Miles Pillsbury, who's a 40-year veteran of the CIA, FBI, and the NSA. So I would recommend a reading, but don't do it when you're at a beach supposed to be relaxing. There were two nights I didn't sleep.
Well, firstly, you have to keep in mind the Chinese have got a lot to lose by provocation. I mean, in the past, as you say, back in the 50s, they were in a closed economy. They had effectively ruined their economy. They had spent, you know, the communists had destroyed the market system, and their growth was meager, and their standard of living was extremely low. It's only when they adopted a market-based economy, a more capitalist-type system, that they started really to grow and accelerate. And so now China is very integrated with the rest of the world. They're our largest supplier, you might say. We import. They're our largest importing country that we import from. So we've integrated their products into our supply chain. The Europeans have done the same thing. They're relying upon us for high-technology goods that they don't produce. So while there may be provocations, they really have got a lot to lose if they you know, create a adverse situation that the U.S. and Europe would retaliate economically. They've also got a lot to. They have to grow to keep their population satisfied, and I don't think they're. You know, I know they're a communist system. They're like a monarchy in the sense of decision making, but they've got to be looking over their shoulders at the population of diverse groups that are more interested in increasing their standard of living than becoming a hegemon for the world.
Very true.
Dan, let's get to this. I'm sorry we didn't give you an opportunity to explain to our listeners. I'd like to do that now. The U.S. Industrial Outlook, when does it come out? What does it cover?
It's a report I do every quarter, every 3 months, and it covers it's a cyclical analysis of 27 industries, and I provide forecasts of 24 of those industries. And it's basically the main manufacturing industries, plus a few other, like some construction and oil and gas drilling. So it's a kind of a snapshot of the cycle, where each of those industries are in the business cycle. So whether they're accelerating growth, decelerating growth, accelerating decline, decelerating decline, the whole business cycle. Of course, most of the sectors are now on the growth side, decelerating growth. But, there are some industries that are still in recession, and there's some industries that are just coming out of a cycle again. So the report kind of gives you a snapshot view of where various industries are in the cycle, and then we talk about the forecast for this year and next and in 2017.
Okay. Now, what is curious that you say some industries are still in recession? What would they be?
Well, right now, some of the weakest sectors would be textile, mill products, which are like rugs and carpets, things that go into housing. The main problem with textiles, is that it's almost disappeared in the United States. A lot of import competition. And the vast bulk of the goods consumed in that sector, that industry, is basically imported. So there's very little manufacturing left, domestic manufacturing left. So that's mainly affected by imports. This year, there was we expect a decline in agricultural equipment production. We also expect a decline because of low commodity prices and falling farm income. We also expect mining and drilling equipment production to decline. For agricultural equipment, we expect it to decline at 10% this year. That's in physical volume. It's 13% decline in mining and drilling equipment this year, and an 18% decline next year. So it's a major correction to low oil and natural gas prices, and falling commodity prices in terms of metals. Another area where we're seeing real weakness and decline is in some of the material sides of manufacturing. So paper production will fall 1% this year. It fell 2% last year. Iron and steel is down 9%, production down 9% this year. And that's, again, that's an import situation. There's a surge of imports of steel given the global overcapacity, particularly in China, for steel mills. And the U.S., you know, we're talking about relatively good, a modest rate of growth in manufacturing, but that's better than most other countries of the world. You know, in Japan, and we're growing faster than Japan and Europe, and with all the excess capacity, it's attracting iron and steel imports into the United States. And also ag chemicals, fertilizers, follows the ag equipment, the decline in commodity prices and lower farm income. We only see a 1% decline in agricultural chemicals this year. So those are a few areas where we see it. If we get into more details and in terms of industries, for example, in construction, non-residential construction is relatively good if you would take out the electric utilities which is called power and communications construction. Those two sectors are pulling down the growth rate, substantially pulling down the growth rate in non-residential construction. But if you look at just industrial construction or manufacturing construction and commercial construction and even other institutional type construction, it's relatively strong. That manufacturing construction will be, you know, double digits, 25% on that range, 28% this year, mainly driven by the areas where there's capacity constraints, food, particularly in the chemicals area, that's driven a lot by the increase in new construction for ethylene plants to take advantage of low natural gas prices. It's spotty. It depends on what industry you're talking about as to what the outlook is.
I think we should talk about aerospace.
Okay. Well, aerospace is one of those industries that should have been growing, or should be growing extremely rapidly. As you know, Boeing has got 5-year backlogs on many other products. The problem has been that they've had these parts failures or system failures, and they've basically had to correct the systems and the new products. But they are starting to ship now new products, you know, the 787, their new freighter, and some other products. It's hurt the an order in the airlines or the aerospace industry is basically a place in the production schedule. They can always cancel or they can always postpone taking delivery. So a lot of the delivery is based upon the current state of the economy. And as you know, like I mentioned before, U.S. is the best looking horse in the glue factory. Things are not so good around the world. A lot of the aerospace orders are from other countries. The U.S. airlines they have a replacement cycle. They are replacing equipment, but most of the demand for aerospace products are in other countries where their travel and freight activities are accelerating, and the new Boeing products particularly have substantial economic advantages in terms of lower fuel use than the old products. For that reason, it's kind of accelerating the depreciation or the replacement. Overall aerospace production, which includes defense and commercial, it was up 2% in 2014, which is production, physical volume was up 2%. We're looking for 3% growth this year, which is just a slight acceleration. So it's kind of at a moderate rate, but we do expect it to accelerate. We're looking for 8% growth in 2016 and 7% growth in 2017. And it could maintain that high single-digit rate for several more years after that, because there's such a long backlog of products. And we do expect the economy to accelerate, not into any kind of a boom, but move from a modest growth rate to a moderate growth rate. And that will cause more spending on plant and equipment, particularly equipment.
Dan, I haven't been keeping up with the competition between Airbus and Boeing. Is my sense of it that Boeing is leading the pack?
I think they're doing a little bit better, yes. They've got the new products that have been well received. So they have up until recently, they had a kind of advantage with the declining value of the dollar. But as you know, in the last three or four or 5 months, the dollar has substantially appreciated, almost very, very quickly at a very short period of time. So they've lost some of that advantage. It does have an effect, but for the most part, Boeing deals in dollars. They sell aircraft in dollars, they don't have the currency translation effect that their industries have. I think Boeing is doing much better, and they may be winning a little bit, but Airbus is not going to disappear anytime soon. That's for sure. It's going to be a formal competitor longer term, like it has been. The Europeans have too much at stake to let Airbus falter. So it will be a major competitor, and it'll be a big. And then you got the other industries like Brazil and Canada with medium-sized jets that they may be eyeing the large jet market. They're going to be expanding. And China wants to build up itself an aerospace industry. So it's aerospace was what steel was about 50 years ago, where if you had a steel, it was like a badge of achievement. So the same thing as applies to aerospace. It's if you can develop a domestic aerospace industry, it's a way of driving technology, driving innovation in your economy. And so other countries are going to target aerospace as much as they can.
You brought up a moment ago Brazil. I'd like to go into that a little deeper. Can you speak on what's going on down there, economically?
Yeah, the socialists ran the economy into the ground. That's basically what happened.
Doesn't take a genius on this one.
it was complete. Brazil looked like it has this history of going socialist and capitalist and socialist and capitalist, and so the socialist government came in basically on the promise of more social programs to improve the situation of the poor, but what they did is they misread the problem in Brazil. So they viewed the problem in Brazil as being lack of demand. And so so they took advantage of that and they think, okay, well, how can I help the economy and help ourselves at the same time? So what they did was they increased public sector wages, increased the minimum wage, raised taxes on business. And then when they found that was slowing the economy, they put controls on trade so that you have to have a export and import license, for Brazilian companies to import and to buy products from abroad, to import products into Brazil. So they're trying to manipulate a trade surplus, but they through this policy of stimulating demand, they were successful. They were able to stimulate demand for consumer goods. Employment dropped. I mean, the unemployment rate dropped, and the wage pressure started to build. And the population for a while felt, you know, they had a substantial improvement in their standard of living, but all they were doing was stoking inflation because the supply side would not respond to the increased demand. So because of heavy regulation of the economy, the inability to import components to go into the products, the extremely high taxes that the government imposed upon them to pay for the social program, the high labor cost that was not offset by productivity increases because business wasn't able to buy or to buy capital equipment or import capital equipment or to produce it domestically because there just wasn't enough reason. The profits were so low. So there was a mismatch. They accelerated demand without the domestic supply increasing, and the result was extremely high inflation rate. So Brazil has one of the highest inflation rates in the world right now. And so then they manipulated their central banks to keep the central bank pumping out money, which now the central bank, because of that, they lost the confidence of the international credit system. So the international investors basically were going to drove up interest rates for Brazilian bonds. So they were forced to bring in a conservative finance minister who basically then reestablished independence of the central bank, which the central bank then had to increase interest rates. So Brazil has one of the highest interest rates in the world as a result. So high interest rates, low productivity, high relative wages, and as a result of this, now the economy is declining. And then they lost their big driver, which is commodity prices. So Brazil very heavy in natural resource exports. So oil prices fell, iron ore prices fell, copper, you know, all the metals prices dropped, which was their the main revenue or main source of foreign revenue, foreign currency. So as a result, they lost their main kind of demand, external demand driver, and their internal demand is being the purchasing power of the households are being eroded by extremely high inflation and high interest rates. Businesses have no incentive to invest.
Another thing that they were doing, Dan, we opened up a sales operation for our forge company to sell forges down into Brazil. And just about when we did that, they raised the duty on our products 30-40%. To make sure that local manufacturers were protected. But what the local manufacturers did was they raised their price to just go underneath the import price with duty, trying mm-hmm. to capitalize on additional profits, which further drove demand down because nobody was going to buy the goods at the higher prices. And they were equal to, in many cases, to the imported prices, so there was no benefit. So that also didn't help the demand track either.
No, and what it's done is it's the industries that are there are protected, and so they have no reason to increase productivity, no reason to be basically internationally competitive. You might want to compare to Mexico. Mexico is the opposite. Mexico floats their currency. They don't have fixed exchange rates. They have always been, and they've been fighting China for market share for years. So the industries in Mexico are, nimble. They respond to market pressures. They're competitive. I mean, they try to increase productivity, and they're internationally competitive. Just the opposite is in Brazil. Brazil has protected its industries. It's not invested. Its productivity is low, and they're not internationally competitive. And so that just means they need more protection. And so it's a vicious circle that the socialist, you know, the socialist type system promulgates or allows to continue. In addition, you got they've messed up their oil industry, the Petrobras, and they've stuffed it with cronies, and it's a jobs program, and the national oil company didn't make investments in the oil field, so their oil production is declining. They had other scandals, political type scandals, corruption, and
there's the word.
And bribery and corruption. This whole crony economy creates this corrosive effect of corruption and bribery. You see it whenever you have a situation where when the economy is not market based. The further it gets away from market based forces, the more likely you're going to get rent seeking people trying to maintain positions through bribery and et cetera. Trying to get political favor, bribery. It all runs with an economy that's not market based.
Well, we're going to be back with Dan Nextroth here from the MAPI, which is the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation, after a quick commercial break and a word from our sponsor.
Manufacturing Talk Radio will be right back.
How do you keep your business humming? Where do you go when you're looking for quality suppliers of new equipment? Components, MRO supplies, repair services, or even raw materials? 30 years ago, you would have turned to the Thomas Register. Today, those big green books are better than ever at thomasnet.com, industry's leading platform for product sourcing and supplier discovery. You can easily find that local machine shop, national distributor, OEM, or any supplier having the right quality certification. Fast and free. You can even get to specific products, components, or downloadable 3D CAD drawings simply by entering specifications or part numbers. There's a reason ThomasNet.com has become the go-to supplier discovery tool for procurement professionals and engineers. There's simply no other resource like it, and it's all free. Go to ThomasNet.com today and see how top-notch supplier discovery doesn't have to put a dent into your bottom line.
American Crane and Equipment Corporation in Douglasville, Pennsylvania is a leader in specialized cranes, hoists, and material handling equipment for industries including aerospace, nuclear, oil and gas, transit, construction, and waste handling. Call 877-877-6778 or visit americancrane.com. That's americancrane.com or 877-877-6778.
All Metals and Forge Group is an ISO 9001 AS and EN 9100 manufacturer of open die forgings and seamless rolled rings in alloy, carbon, stainless and tool steels, aluminum, copper, titanium, and nickel alloys. Visit us at steelforge.com or call 800-600-9290.
Welcome back to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
Welcome back, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. We're speaking with Dan Nextroth, who is Vice President and Chief Economist for the MAPI Foundation, the research affiliate of the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. And Dan is talking about his U.S. Industrial Outlook report that he puts out quarterly, and we've been talking about some of the segments within it. Dan, since our sponsor, All Metals and Forge Group, is in the metals industry, how does the metals industry look for the balance of 2015 going into 2016?
Well, you mean in terms of primary metals or in fabricated metals?
Well, let's talk about
primary
both.
Metals.
Let's talk about both, sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mentioned primary metals. The steel industry is going to decline this year pretty substantially. So we're looking for a 9% decline in steel production in 2015, and then a rebound of 4% growth in 2016 and 5% growth in 2017. The main reason for the decline this year is trade, and you know there are the other markets are moderate, but the what's really driving it down is the trade situation, the surge in imports. For the aluminum industry, no gain in production this year, and 3% gain next year, and 5% gain in 2017. In terms of fabricated metals, fabricated metal products, it's made up of many different industries. So forging and stampings actually should do fairly well this year, although it's slower growth than it was in 2014. So we're looking for 6% growth in forging and stamping production this year, and 2% growth in 2016, 2% growth in 2017. And that's basically driven by the strong machinery production in general, except for the ag machinery and the mining and drilling machinery. In terms of other industries, so the hand tools or the power tools, in hand tools, in cutlery, that's down 7% this year. We expect about 1% growth next year, 2% growth in 2017. Architectural and structural metals is doing very well. So I mentioned before, there's a kind of a rebound, a strong rebound in commercial and industrial construction, which is and also the housing industry. Housing starts are up substantially this year, or substantially in terms of percentage change. So we're looking for housing starts to increase 10% in 2015, 19% in 2016, and 12% in 2017. So that helps this architectural and structural metals, but particularly it's driven by non-res construction, non-res buildings construction. Hardware, very slow growth in the outlook. You know, 1%, 1 to 1.5% growth each of the next 3 years. Spring and wire products should be up about 6% this year. It was up 9.5% last year. I think it's driven by automotive and building supplies. So it goes into the construction sector and the automotive sector. And then we're looking for 2% growth in 2016 and 17 for spring and wire products. Coating and engraving and heat treating, virtually no growth this year, and 1.5% growth in 2016 and 17. Those are the major components of fabricated metal products. So overall, fabricated metal products are going to be up 3% this year, which is a little slower than the 4% growth last year, and then we're looking for 3% next year and about 2.5% growth in 2017.
Dan, just so that our listeners know, because you put this report together quarterly, is this released through MAPI to the general public or to the industry in general?
Yes, it's on our website, MAPI.net/research. So, or if you go in the website, MAPI.net, you look for the research tab, and that's where you'll find all our economic publications and forecasts. So we have paper, print publications, but we also do webinars, and we do PowerPoint with audio videos that's available through the website.
Yes, I would certainly encourage any of our listeners who are interested in this to go to MAPI.net. A lot of great information that the organization puts out. Lou, you had a comment?
Yeah. Dan, in your report, you're showing the oil and gas declines this year 13% and another additional 18% next year.
Mm-hmm.
And this all is... naturally, it's going to affect our economy. And then you see a turnaround in 17 of a 12% increase. Does this Iranian deal have any impact on that that you see? And I'll presume that it's probably a negative impact. You want to throw in your comments on that?
It's kind of strange. You have to look at it two ways as to what's the effect on the U.S. economy in general, a macro effect, and then what's the effect on manufacturing. So, you know, in general, lower oil prices, lower natural gas prices are good for the economy. I mean, in effect, what you're doing is you're shifting out the supply curve. So at every price, there's more production. And even though that's causes deflation or falling prices, you know, it's generally good for the economy because of technological change for the most part. So which caused the drop in oil prices and natural gas prices is the fact that there's been a technological advance in drilling. So you have fracking and you have horizontal drilling. They really started in about 2008 and accelerated from there. It's turned around domestic production of oil and natural gas. I mean, oil was declining. Oil and gas production was declining for many, you know, for decades, particularly oil. And then all of a sudden, this new technology has turned it around. And since 2008, oil production is increased 4.6 million barrels a day. When people were talking about us being totally dependent on oil in a couple decades, now it looks like by the end of the decade, we may be totally self-sufficient. So it's really a miracle. And the consumers benefit from that because everybody's paying lower oil prices. We drive our cars, it's less expensive. You buy to heat our homes with natural gas or oil, fuel oil, it's less. It's all the industries that use the feedstocks or oil and natural gas as inputs are benefiting. So you see in terms of the industries that consume oil. So consumers, I mentioned before, but also the fuel users like the transportation sector. So whether it's railroads, whether it's aerospace or shipping, trucks, ships, everything, everybody that uses oil is going to benefit from low oil prices. You also have the feedstock users. So some industries use, particularly in manufacturing, use natural gas. They use very little oil is used in manufacturing, extremely small amount. What's really used is natural gas. So the organic chemicals they create ethylene and use the products into organic chemicals. They're going to benefit because the feedstock cost is gone down substantially. Agricultural chemicals, particularly nitrogen chemicals, I mean, it's a feedstock into that process, and so they benefit. Become more competitive internationally. We have this huge advantage internationally. It's not just falling prices, but already low prices relative to the rest of the world, and it's falling. And then plastics and resins, again, where natural gas is a feedstock. And then there are some industries that in manufacturing that use heat that benefit from lower heat costs. So paper, metals, cement, and electric utilities. They all benefit from the lower cost of heat. So there's a lot of industries and sectors that benefit from low gas prices. So the net macro effect is positive. But it turns out that there's some industries that are hurt. So obviously the oil producers are hurt, and the oil producers buy drilling equipment, and the whole oil country goods supply chain has been hurt by this drop in oil prices. And major oil producers, exporters, I should say, like Venezuela, Russia, both in major recessions right now, Kuwait, Saudis, Iran, they're in recessions. I mean, Iran didn't negotiate this deal because things are great in Iran. They did because their population's revolting against poor economic performance. So, you know, low oil prices do hurt certain segments. In general, it seems that in manufacturing, what's happened is that the consumers benefited from low oil prices, and they did spend, they had a one-time positive shock in the fourth quarter of last year, and they did accelerate spending in the fourth quarter, but it didn't continue. So it looks like consumers have primarily used the money to pay down debt and reliquify themselves. So we didn't get a big surge in spending because of low from consumers based on lower oil prices or lower natural gas and gasoline prices. So it looks like the net effect on manufacturing has actually been negative. But for the economy as a whole, it is a net positive effect.
Well,
so
let me ask,
manufacturing is hurt more by the drop in production, production of the equipment and oil country supply chain, than it is helped by low oil and natural gas prices as a heat user or as a feedstock user.
Let me ask you this, going back to the oil and gas, the field machinery equipment, if we're pumping out more fuel and more gas than we ever have and may become self-sufficient, don't we need replacement on equipment and wear and tear and maintenance?
Where you need more storage facilities, you need more pipeline
right.
capacity. So, I mean, yes, you do. You're correct that the volume, although the price has gone down, the volume has gone up. And so you need facilities to handle that additional volume. But remember, for the most part, we're just replacing imports. That is, U.S. is still a net importer right now. Right now, give you a perspective, in 2007, the U.S. had a net imports of 12 million barrels a day. That was our net imports. That's when people were projecting that we would be totally dependent upon foreign oil. Then by this year, 2015, we're a net importer of 4 million barrels a day. So we went from importing 12 million barrels a day to 4 million barrels a day. We've substantially reduced our imports, but we still are a net importer. And what we're doing by increasing domestic production, we're just replacing imports with domestic production.
Mm-hmm.
The consumption of oil overall is not increasing. In fact, oil consumption has been declining because it's been relatively high priced for, 5-6 years.
Right.
And so consumers users have substituted away from oil to natural gas. And then also we've got this whole environmental issue and conservation where the economy has become much more efficient user of energy. We don't need as much energy to produce a dollar of GDP as we did in the past. And that's actually pretty strong downward pressure on the use of oil. Consumers in terms of people and also industrial users and utilities are using much less energy to produce output than they have in the past. So what I'm saying is that it's true that you need more infrastructure, but when you're replacing domestic for imports, the total volume that you're moving has actually been declining, and,
mm-hmm.
and you need to replace the infrastructure, obviously. But I think the buildup in the whole oil country supply chain was really more about how do you get the production, which was in North Dakota and in some of these in Texas and other places where the outer parts of Texas and the major fields, the shale fields, were not equipped with the pipelines that they needed to move that production into the major distribution lines. The drilling equipment, the pipe to drill, and then also the lines to move the oil to the major arteries to get it into the system. But that has slowed down, obviously, and the lower oil prices go, the longer they stay below $50 a barrel, the faster the infrastructure is going to collapse. It's going to implode on itself because it doesn't seem that the estimates I see is that you need $50 a barrel for unconventional shale oil to be competitive, to be break even. That's kind of the break even point. So when it goes up to the $60 range, then you know you get more production. But when it drops down to 40, you're not. It's going to start continue to implode.
And the dollar price today was 50.87 just prior to showtime today.
Yeah, I mean there's some fields that are going to be competitive at low prices. Some of the unconventional fields are competitive, but it may be some producers are better at the technology than others, and maybe they can be a little bit more competitive at 50. But you know, that seems to be what the industry is estimating, or what experts I've talked to seem to think that is the break-even point for shale. But you know, if you can find a big field that's not unconventional, a regular field, I mean, there's still discoveries out there that could be produced at less than $50. But I think what you're seeing is that it looked like things were stabilizing. You know, the rig count was stabilizing when it got above 50. And if it drops, if this additional Iranian production would come on stream, it may depress prices. It would probably depress prices further, but I don't think it would be a major shock, because that oil is moving anyway. It's been going through the black market. It's being, you know, oil is very fungible. It trades around the world. So there will be additional production that wouldn't have occurred that, you know, that they can sell now, but you know, I don't think it's going to cause a collapse of oil, because it's all oil prices ready to lower.
They also claim that it's going to take almost a year for Iran to get fully up to speed, so it'll be a gradual feed into the market.
Right.
And you're right. I agree with you. It probably won't be a major
shock.
Just
so I remember, the point I wanted to make is there's two sides of the market. There's the demand side, and there's the supply side. And the lower the prices get, the less likely producers are to drill more for more oil. And there's a fairly high depletion rate, particularly when you deal in the shale fields. Those wells don't last nearly as long as the conventional wells do. They need to be, you know, they play out fairly quickly. And so you could see, if oil prices stay below 50 for a long period of time, for years, then you would see supply actually start shrinking. And all we need is another kind of rebound. If we're right in that there's a general global rebound next year and the year after, I'm not calling for a boom by any means, but going from moderate, that will soak up some demand, or will boost demand a little bit, and particularly in other countries.
And we want to thank you for joining us here on Manufacturing Talk Radio. We encourage everyone to go to napi.net to take a look at this U.S. industrial outlook. Dan, enjoyed having you on the show again. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, bye.
And Lou, what have we got coming up here?
Next week we are going to have green manufacturing. We are going to be talking about the environmental responsibility and financial costs that it takes to become a successful green manufacturer. We're going to be talking about cleaner production processes and more efficient resource management. We will be looking at how that's going to affect the bottom line, and the cost to do so may not be as big a deal as those who are not fully aware of it as to what the cost will be to generate that extra profit for their organizations. So we're looking forward to having several guests on regarding green manufacturing. I look forward to next week. Tim?
Yeah, it should be a very interesting show. I'm always fascinated by green manufacturing, to see the advances that have been made, and there was always a lot of talk, and it would cost you more than you could probably sell the product for. Don't think that's true anymore, and we'll hear more about that next week.
Well, that's like our robot show of last week, Rethink Robotics, in that for $30,000 you can have a whiz-bang computer that you'll see a return on your investment in less than a year. So the technology is driving profits.
Yeah, clearly. Amazing stuff. And that kind of wraps us up today for Manufacturing Talk Radio.